Hello, you're listening to Tech Tent from the BBC World Service with me, Zoe Kleinman. In this episode, we're exploring ChatGPT, the AI text generator that's gone viral. It's been hailed for its human-like answers to requests for it to generate everything from exam essays to poems.
I asked it to be able to talk about the Scottish weather in the style of the King James Bible, and it generated really fantastic, really fluid, natural results.
According to its makers, more than a million of us have tried it out in the week since it went public. But what are the limitations of this kind of tech? Also coming up, we hear from former tennis world number one Billie Jean King on how technology could change the game.
How do you get a seven-year-old interested in your sport? You can't think like my generation. What are they like? They like technology. Hello, let's use it and make it fun for them.
And just how easy is it to fix an iPhone yourself? When you're chatting to a computer program, you don't always get the most realistic of answers. Believe me, I've tried loads. But an artificial intelligence chatbot that's just been made public has been attracting a lot of attention for its authenticity. ChatGPT was released by OpenAI last week. And since then, they say more than a million people have had a go at asking the program all sorts of things, from difficult exam questions to writing stories in the style of Harry Potter. We thought we'd ask it to write a script about itself, and then we voiced it using a different website because, remember, it's text only, it doesn't speak.
ChatGPT is a large language model developed by OpenAI, one of the leading research institutions in the field of artificial intelligence. This model has been trained on a massive amount of text data, allowing it to generate human-like responses to a wide range of topics. One of the unique features of ChatGPT is its ability to continue a conversation based on previous inputs. This means that users can ask follow-up questions and ChatGPT will provide relevant and coherent responses. In addition to its conversational capabilities, ChatGPT can also generate text on a variety of topics, including news articles, poetry, and even jokes. This makes it a valuable tool for tasks such as content creation and language translation. Overall, ChatGPT is an exciting development in the world of language processing and artificial intelligence.
I went along to the University of Glasgow to meet some students researching in the field of artificial intelligence, and we asked them what they made of it.
It gives us as researchers the capability to kind of do more with our research. So things that might have been impossible before with traditional models, with ChatGPT, we're able to kind of explore those options and to do more with our research.
I was on the train yesterday and I was playing with it, and it's very great at generating language. For example, I had some Spanish homework I had to do, and it's very great at writing essays for you, which is obviously dangerous, but as an inspiration, that could work very well.
It's instructing the public just how capable some of these AI systems are. And it's also shedding light on some of the limitations that the systems can have with respect to accuracy of their statements, how grounded what they're saying is in the real world.
OpenAI has also warned that it can produce problematic answers and says it's keen to collect feedback to further develop it. Dr. Jeff Dalton is lecturer in AI at the University of Glasgow, and he gave me his thoughts.
So ChatGPT is really exciting. It's the evolution of things we do every day. We type, we text, we write emails, and existing AI technology is really fantastic in that maybe it helps us autocomplete a word, it helps us check our grammar, but ChatGPT is fantastic because it takes it to the next level.
You've had a play with it, haven't you?
Yes, so I asked it to generate a poem about Stephen Hawking's theory about wormholes in the style of Robert Burns. And it generated really fantastic results that I was really happy with that were very fun and entertaining.
What are its limits?
So ChatGPT was trained to be able to say the right things to you, to have it sound like good English, but it's really prone to hallucinating. And so its limits are actually getting to what's true. And that's something we need to change.
Where has it actually got this, all of its information from?
So ChatGPT is a language model. It's trained on all sorts of web information, Wikipedia, Twitter data, a huge collection of the internet that we have today, almost 57 billion lifetimes of text, huge amounts of information that it reads over and over and over again to try to memorize the information. But it can't access the web. It doesn't access search. it's not up to date. So if you look at ChatGPT, it's only encoded, it knows what it knows, and it can't be updated.
Oh, it's not learning.
It's not actively learning, which is actually what makes it not become toxic, because the OpenAI controls what information it reads and how it reads it.
And yet, lots of people, including me, who've played with it, have found that it will share misinformation quite freely, and it doesn't tell you where it's got it from. Do you think that's a problem?
So I think that it is a problem. We want our information agents, we want our virtual assistants to give us the correct factual sourced information. And that's something that my research group at Glasgow has been working on.
Here we are at Glasgow University. If I was a student here and I had hefty essays to write, I think I'd be quite excited about the potential of maybe borrowing the talents of ChatGPT. How are you going to keep an eye out for that?
So as a teacher and educator, I already keep an eye out for plagiarism. And I know when they copy from each other, it's pretty obvious. And ChatGPT, the information that it's copying it from the web, just like the students already do. And so I can already see and recognize those patterns. And it's something that teachers will learn and adapt to.
So you don't think that it's a threat to education?
I don't think it's a threat for education. I think it's actually a valuable tool to be able to help people learn content in a new form. And that's what really excites me.
People have had a lot of fun with it.
Yes.
How easy is it to get it to do something that it shouldn't?
There's been some major advances in trying to keep these things safe, keep them controllable, to keep them from being toxic. And that's something that continues to be researched in, is continuing to evolve. There's over 1 million people using ChatGPT in the first week alone. And Chat and OpenAI will be learning from what those people, how they circumvent those controls.
So we are part of the experiment.
We are part of the experiment. And that's a really exciting experiment to be part of.
So who is OpenAI? I've been speaking to Callum Chase, an AI expert, to find out more about the organization.
So OpenAI is a research organization established in 2015 to create some competition in the field of advanced AI. Elon Musk was one of the co-founders of OpenAI, along with a man called Sam Altman. They're two extremely successful Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, and they did it to create some competition in the field of very advanced AI, because at that point, there was a bit of a monopoly of DeepMind, which is owned by Google.
Some people are still concerned about the pace of AI, aren't they?
Yes, it's developing very fast in the research field. Curiously, not so much in the industrial deployment field, but in the research field, practitioners are surprised by how quickly these modern systems are developing. And some of them are starting to think we may have systems as smart as humans in as little as 10 years, which is sooner than most people thought previously.
At the moment, it's not a very profitable business to be in, though, is it?
Well, AI is making a lot of money for some companies. Google and Facebook have taken over huge amounts of the advertising industry using a form of AI known as deep learning. At the moment, I don't think OpenAI is making a great deal of money with ChatGPT or any of its other systems, but you can see how they will do in the future. And some people are already thinking that ChatGPT is a serious threat to Google search, for instance.
Why is that?
Because it's so good at retrieving information and presenting it back to the user in a very, very helpful format. ChatGPT-3 isn't linked to the internet, but it's trained on an enormous amount of data going up to as recent as 2021. And you can ask it to give you a little bit of information, or you can ask it to write a sonnet or write a marketing plan, and it will do those things pretty well. It's far from perfect, but it is really impressive.
Microsoft very notoriously had its fingers burned with chatbots early on, and yet it is now an investor in this one.
That's right. Microsoft launched a chatbot called Tay 2 or 3 years ago, and within 24 hours, the good people on the internet had turned it into a raging psychopath. Companies have learned from that, and they're very keen not for it to happen again. But it's hard. I mean, I've got ChatGPT-3 to say one or two things which I would not repeat in public. So, these systems are very sophisticated, and they bring with them, because of the way they're trained, they bring with them all the bias of humanity. And we, as a species, are immensely biased.
Just over a year ago, the whistleblower Frances Haugen sent shockwaves around the world, leaking a series of internal documents about the way Meta, which owns Facebook, WhatsApp and Instagram, moderates certain accounts. It prompted the firm to ask its oversight board to review a program called CrossCheck, where policy-breaking posts by high-profile accounts weren't automatically removed, but given an extra level of review instead. Now, the board has said that the system treated users unequally, and it's given 32 recommendations on how the process should be changed. Nigat Dad is a member of the Meta Oversight Board and the founder of Digital Rights Foundation in Pakistan, and she joins me now. Hi, Nigat.
Hi.
Let's start with CrossCheck. Can you explain how that works and what you're worried about?
Meta basically describes CrossCheck as a program that provides additional levels of review for certain content that their internal system flags as violating either via automation or human review. And the goal for them is to prevent or minimize the highest risk false positive moderation errors. And how Meta defines false positive is basically the mistaken removal of content that does not violate the content policies that establish what is allowed on Facebook and Instagram. So under ERSR, Meta selects a list of users, entities whose posts are entitled the benefit of extra level of review, despite the fact that the content identified as violating the community standards of the company. So previously the program lacked proper governance and thoughtful processes, which sort of resulting in violating content remaining on the platform for days, weeks, and even in some cases, months at a time.
I mean, I suppose there's two ways of looking at this, aren't there? You could say there are certain people who are such massive world leaders that you need to hear what they're saying. I know that was Mark Zuckerberg's opinion about Donald Trump when he was president, that, you know, although he was clearly breaking Meta's rules on Facebook, because he was a world leader, you needed to hear what he had to say. And then there's the argument that these accounts are potentially more commercially valuable, aren't they? Because so many people look at them.
What we noticed and identified that currently neither it is designed nor implemented in a manner that meets Meta's stated human rights commitments and values. And to comply with Meta's stated human rights commitments and company values, a system to prevent over-enforcement should be structured substantially differently, you know. One of our key findings was that, and also surprising and shocking for us, that violating content was often left up for days and sometimes even weeks and months. I mean, one data point that we received was that at times harmful content was remained at the platform for more than 7 months.
Months, that's a long time.
Yeah, it's 222 days, so 7 months. Whereas what company says that the content can be reviewed for 5 days, and so the 5 days is actually their stated sort of time frame, and it overly prioritizes business concerns and provides extra protection to certain users selected largely according to business interests. So which definitely not really reflects what the company says about the program.
Would the oversight board like to see Meta just ditch CrossCheck? Is it not working?
Well, I think it depends on what Meta would like to see with the program, but we have given 32 recommendations, and I think board believes that the program is there because it's needed, but company definitely can take steps to make it equal for every user on the platform and make it and be more transparent about the platform about the program. So some of the recommendations that we gave basically to the company was that prior to, if you are saying that this is to prioritize the human rights, the commitment of the company, then prioritize users and expressions that are important for human rights and of public importance. So, for instance, journalists or human rights defenders or other vulnerable users whose expression is more important from the perspective of human rights. And also, you know, as I already said, radically, the Green Duo radically increased the transparency around the program and how it operates, audit the program, measure the impact, make it public so that public can hold the company accountable around, you know, how the program is working and let the users decide whether it's working or not, you know. So the decision should be of the users, not really the company.
Nagat Dad, thank you. That's Nagat Dad from the Meta Oversight Board. Meta said, we have teams and resources devoted to improving the cross-check system to fully address the number of recommendations we've agreed with the board to review and respond within 90 days. Now, anyone for tennis? You probably don't want to play with me because I'm absolutely terrible at it. Or maybe you do want to play with me because you'd almost certainly win. Anyway, all sport is being transformed by technology, helping competitors shoot more accurately, find out about their key statistics, and also assisting officials to make decisions on foul play, sometimes controversially, as we all know. Our reporter Shona McCallum's been finding out how tennis is embracing tech, and she joins me now. Shona, hello. What tech have you seen and would it help me?
Yeah, well, this technology is really aimed at the professionals, so I'm not sure that it'll help you, Zoe.
That sounds like a no.
But it was really great to try it out at the Billie Jean King Cup finals in Glasgow. Now, it's a big tournament, more than 100 countries involved, the largest annual international team competition in women's sport, this year being won by Switzerland. And in this type of scenario, all of the countries were really embracing this technology, which is being rolled out by Microsoft. Essentially, it uses the various ball tracking cameras. If you've watched Wimbledon, you might have seen the Hawkeye, where they contest the line calls. So they've got the ball tracking cameras around the courts and 3D radar systems, and that all links up and looks at the statistics and shows you where the players are hitting the balls, whether or not that's serving down the line or how they're striking their backhands. And it basically collects all this information. The data can then be accessed via the cloud platform, and then it means the professionals and their coaches can see it in real time and actually give advice as the matches are going on. So when you think of professional sports, and tennis is no different, it really comes down to these fine margins. You know, a millimetre or two in tennis can actually really make the difference. And so the idea is that the technology will look at all of the statistics, the coaches can read it, and they can say, right, okay, make these small incremental changes in the game, and that can really shape the fate of the game. And I think the main pioneer, the one that's making it happen, is Billie Jean King herself. She's a legend of the game. She's won many, many Grand Slams, and it was a pleasure to talk to her about it.
It's really important for champions and everyone to know their strengths. But what champions do is they practice their strength every day. Because everybody talks about mistakes all the time, but you first want to know what your strength is. So there's a combination of things you can learn with the Microsoft tablet. You want to look at, okay, what do I do really well? Like, but that verifies it. So you go, okay, I'm on the right track. And then you find out what isn't going so well. So when you look there and you see these stats, I wish, oh my God, I would have given anything to have what you guys have, because I like all this. I love information. I love learning. I love all these things. And our generation, we couldn't even look at videos. We didn't have videos to look at. We never got to see ourselves. And that would have helped me. I mean, in one day would have helped me. And I mean, like, just to see me play even. So it's like, this is amazing opportunity for everyone.
And how much of a better player do you think you may have been if you'd had access to this?
So much better. Because I was very adaptable and I could learn quickly, you know, if someone showed me something, and I love challenges. The number one's always love challenges. I mean, Chris Evert, Martina Navratilova, all these different players I've helped or been captain of a Fed Cup team now, Billie Jean King Cup. You learn that champions just love challenges, but they always like to keep learning. And I know someone like Martina, Navratilova, Chris Evert, if they'd also had the Microsoft tablet, would have just loved it. And some people don't like too much, so you have to figure out how to use it. But it's you know, the Microsoft tablet's so adaptable, you can set it up any way you want. I mean, you can find out about your RPMs, you know, how much spin on the ball. You can find out trajectory. You can find out, you know, percentage of first and second serves. So, yeah, I think it's fun.
And how do you see this technology?
Oh, it's going to get better and better and more sophisticated like everything else. Just give you more. The important thing is to know how to, you know, extract the real information you need to help you. That takes some ability how to choose because... And glean, I love a lot of information. Some players do not like a lot of information. Just tell me one thing or tell me nothing. I go, give me the book. Just give me everything. And then I glean the information I think I need for me. But everyone's different in how their brain works, how quickly their brain goes. You have to know, it helps you to learn about yourself. I just think it teaches you so many things, and I love it. And I love the fact that, it's going to get more and more sophisticated as time goes on. But there's no reason... You know, everybody in the stands should probably be seeing all this. That's what I'd like to see. I want more and more interaction with the spectators.
So you'd like that to be openly available so people can see?
Oh, love it. Listen, how do you get a 7-year-old interested in your sport? You can't think like my generation, we're kaput. No, you have to think, how do I keep getting young people? What do they like? They like technology. Hello, let's use it and make it fun for them. And also, it teaches you what's really going on and better facts. Because it adds so much to the experience. And children today and young people want experiences. My generation wasn't brought up with that. They all want experiences. What affords you experience? Technology. And I'm big on technology. I think it's going to help continue to help our sport, but it'll help all sports. But more importantly, look at the medical profession, how much it's helped. I mean, it's saved lives.
Billie Jean King there. Big fan of technology, also, I'm sure, big fan of tech tents. What was she like, Shona, to meet?
Do you know what? She's one of those people that lights up a room and really has that kind of presence, like the star quality. So she was really great to interview, and she had so many great ideas about how tech could really bring tennis into the kind of new era, how a lot of the old stuffy traditions should be doing away with. You know, it's only just this year that they're saying that women don't need to necessarily wear white at Wimbledon because we all know the issues that that causes, you know. So she's such a champion for women, gender equality, and now technology.
It takes a certain amount of courage to start taking apart a broken smartphone and attempting to fix it yourself. But the right to repair movement is growing around the world, accompanied by legislation in some countries, forcing the tech giants to make it easier for us to do some DIY repair. Now Apple has extended its self-service repair scheme to a number of European countries, meaning iPhone 12 and 13 users and some MacBook owners are able to fix their own devices by buying parts and tools and watching online tutorials. But how easy is it really? The scheme's already been in place in the US for a while, where Dan Barbara from tech website MacRumors had a go, and he joins me now. Dan, hello.
Hello, how's it going?
All right, thank you. What was it that you tried to fix?
So we tried to do what is supposed to be the easiest thing, and that is taking apart the phone to replace the battery.
I would have gone for the easiest one as well.
Yeah, well, it wasn't that easy. I mean, Apple tries to make it as easy as possible by giving you all of their tools that you have to rent out for $1,300 as a charge, unless you forget to send it back. That will be removed, but that's kind of what's holding over your head. So you have to be careful with all of these things. And it's also over 79 pounds when delivered. So it's not the easiest process to get things set up, but the tools themselves make it easy. You just really, really need to focus on what you're doing.
Talk me through the process. I had to look at some of the manuals, and there were like 61 steps involved in changing a screen on an iPhone 13.
Yeah, I mean, if you're, you know, someone who really reads the directions and takes their time, you shouldn't be having that much of a problem. But I try to read it, and then you kind of get cocky and feel like you know what you're doing. And you start to just not really like, you know, you start to glance over things. And don't do that, because I have noticed many times, well, the one time that I did it, I tried to take off the part of the display, and I didn't have my screen protector taken off, and I didn't even realize that that was on there. So I had to take that off first, but the display was already starting to lift up, and I was worried that I started to do damage.
Yeah.
But once you get everything taken out, the hardest part is getting around all the adhesive and getting the battery out and then back in without puncturing it, because if you do that, it could not explode, but it will catch on fire, and that's not something a normal person who wants to replace their battery would want.
No, a battery on fire is the last thing anybody wants. How long did it take you?
If you don't mess up and if you have the proper tools, I think some of the biggest things is that Apple gives you the tools and everything to rent out, but there are some things that are in the manual that you just don't get, like fire protective gloves for when you're using the adhesive, the display removal. That stuff gets really hot and you don't want to touch it with just your hands. And you need like kind of a syringe or a needle to be able to like squirt some of the alcohol in underneath the battery to really get that to loosen the adhesive. And those are just things that I didn't have. I would say maybe a couple of hours, like maybe 2 to 3 hours of straight work. But, that doesn't include the times of like having to get all of these things and setting it up. And if you mess up, going back, that took me overall at least a day and a half to just kind of really go through everything and make sure we had everything. But we did successfully do it in the end. So I think that's something that is worth pointing out. Yeah, I'm proud of myself. I'll pat myself on the back.
I would feel hugely proud of myself. Would you do it again?
No, because what you do need to realize is that if you're doing this for your battery, it is actually far more cost effective, at least in the US. I'm not sure what it is for everywhere else. It's only $69 to have Apple swap out the battery and replace them themselves without warranty. And it's $95 plus that $1,300 authorization charge to do it yourself. So that just doesn't make any sense.
Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it from us. You can find the BBC Tech Reporter team on Twitter @BBC Tech and me @ZSK.